So I get asked a lot, being in my 40s, how do I manage to continue to perform all season long at the level that I do? Well, you know, it's a lot of hard work, but I have a lot of help. Triple Threat Performance has been putting this old body back together again for years. I keep tearing it down, and they keep putting me back together. And now, apart from the physical therapy side, I got involved in their athletic training program. And honestly, I don't think the Mountains stand a chance this season. So if you're in the Phoenix area and you're interested in upping your game, check them out at www.ttpaz.com. That's ttpaz.com. Now let's roll into the next episode.
Hi, welcome to the Interviews with the Hunting Masters, brought to you by Phoenix Shooting Bags. It's springtime, but I don't know what it is. Something about spring, I always got elk on the brain. And even though it's not the first season that comes along, or, you know, the first thing that I hunt when season comes on, I always, you know, hunt deer before elk season comes. It's always on my brain first for some reason. So I wanted to pick a couple of guys' brains about what they do in the off season to prepare for elk season. And I have Chris Horton on with us from Elk Addicts, and we're going to talk to him a little bit about what he does in the off season to get ready for the elk season. Consequently, this is going to be the first of, I guess, my elk series that I'm going to be doing here. What's going on, Chris? I know you've been on the show, but Chris, why don't you give us a little rundown about yourself?
All right. Thanks, John. I'm Chris Horton with Elk Addicts. I started Elk Addicts back end of 2015. And basically, we're social media for elk hunting. We have a member-based group on Facebook that has a little over 94,000 elk hunters where we talk gear, tactics, all the fun stuff. And then you can also find us on Instagram under Elk Addicts and YouTube also. That's kind of our new thing. And myself under as Elk Addict Chris. And basically, we live, eat, breathe elk hunting. And it's kind of a year-round deal for us. From, you know, hunting them in the fall, archery and rifle, to shen hunting in the spring and then scouting all summer. So it's kind of a year-round obsession, addiction.
Yeah,
but
nice. I don't really ever get to do much shed hunting. It's crazy because, like, that time of year, I'm so busy with my construction company that my pool company, and it's so tough for me to go. And our snakes are so bad. Like, and because our deer drop super late, the elk drop now. And, you know, I don't know. I went as far as training a couple of dogs to do it, and I still,
yeah.
I still don't get to go, you know, it's weird, but,
well, for me, it's a good way to stay in shape.
Yeah.
You know, I go to the gym, but I never. For the gym, I use for lifting weights for the most part and strength training. I hate doing cardio at the gym. But I have no problem throwing a pack on, hiking mountains for an entire day, putting on 10, 15 miles pretty easily, chasing sheds. And you'll get a lot better cardio out of that than running on the treadmill for a half hour or something
that. Oh, yeah, sure.
So, I mean, you know, for me, it's a big part of my early season and, you know, keeping myself in elk shape. And you don't always find sheds, but it's kind of like the big kid Easter egg hunt out there, if you would. And it allows me to, a lot of the elk that I chase sheds for are elk that I will be chasing in the fall. Mm-hmm. I follow them down to the winter range where they winter. So it allows me to see a lot of the bigger bulls I'll recognize from trail camera pictures and stuff like that, to where it allows me to kind of see who survived, who's around, who's available to be have a chance at this year.
Right. So it's not some, because you said, you mentioned that they're in winter range, so they're not going to be, your shed hunting is not really scouting for where elk are going to be when you're going to be hunting them. It's more for taking an inventory of what's there and what survived and what could possibly be there when fall comes around.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for our elk, they're migrating out of a high country, you know, in that 10,000-foot range. So right now I use the government snowtell system, which has sensors all over the state and the Northwest, to see what the snow levels are at. Well, currently, one of the basins I elk hunt in, you know, or in that area, I guess it's not in the same basin. It's over a ways, but the closest snowtell is at 85 inches of snow right now. So,
wow. So
there's no elk going to be in there for quite a while.
Right.
But I am able to go see and look for certain bulls on the winter range that will migrate back into that country. And, you know, I certainly don't find all the bulls in the winter because it's such a broad area where they winter. But I typically have a pretty good idea on a few of them that I see that have unique characteristics to them that allows me to know, you know, they were a bull I've seen, not seen, you know, and it's just fun, you know, like, right, it just gives me a good excuse to be outside in elk country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. What are some of the other things you're doing, you know, to prepare yourself for elk season? You mentioned, you know, doing the cardio. What are some of the other things you're doing? It doesn't have to be physical fitness, just, you know, mental preparedness, practicing.
Yeah.
What are things you do?
Well, a big thing is shooting my bow throughout the year and not just picking it up a week before archery season thinking I'm going to go, you know, be able to shoot 60 yards and hit what I'm aiming at, right?
Right.
You know, for me, archery is a year-round deal. We're pretty, you know, lucky here to have an archery range that has a 24-hour pass. So I can literally go shoot in the evening at 9, 10, 11 o'clock at night when nobody else is there. And it's a range out to 60 yards. You know, so it's a pretty neat little deal here. And you can get a little, it's just a little door code that you hit, almost like a gym.
Cool.
So that makes it cool for us to be able to shoot here year-round, even when the weather's bad. And then another thing, you know, I like to ski and mountain bike. Yeah, those are good ways to keep, you know, your legs good and strong. And, you know, on top of that, of the shed hunting really allows me to keep in good shape and keep in elk shape. Because the thing I've found for preseason conditioning, if you elk hunt every year, it's easier just to stay in decent shape, stay in good shape, rather than being, you know, I'm going to get in good shape 2 months before elk season, get in elk shape, and then, you know, it's way easier to maintain throughout a year than it is to try to rebuild every year because it's just going to get harder and harder. So
that's for sure.
It just allows me to be further ahead and go places where other people, you know, don't. You know, plus this time of year, there's not very many people out there. Like where I'm watching bulls right now, I got a herd of bulls I've been watching that they've shed. A few of them have shed, but a lot of them haven't. But I'm snowshoeing in a mile and a half to be able to glass them.
Wow.
You know, so, you know, nobody's going back in there. I'm the only person been back in there probably in the entire winter. You know, there's no snowmobile trails. There's no accessible roads. And, you know, so being back in there, it's pretty cool when you can be back in there and you got it basically all to yourself. You can watch the animals. You see mountain lions. You see, you know, a lot of, you know, deer, elk, moose. And, you know, it's just a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Let's switch gears a little bit. Let's talk about scouting.
Okay.
What does your scouting look like? When do you start? What are you doing?
Well, for me, I honestly like that Snowtel that I mentioned before. I will watch that religiously until it hits zero. I know when it hits, because it's on a south-facing slope in the area, so it loses snow quicker than, let's say, the north-facing stuff.
Yep.
When that snowtail hits zero, there's areas I know that are still going to have quite a bit of snow, but for the most part, I'll be able to get into there. And okay. I like to get into areas. There's typically some elk in the area there that have migrated in, but a majority of elk aren't even there yet when I get in there. And I set cameras, and I start, you know, putting cameras out as soon as I possibly can. This year we have more snow. Last year I was able to have cameras out in early May.
Mm-hmm.
This year I probably will not be able to get into those areas until late May. It might be bumping June.
Wow.
But basically for myself, you know, because I live not near but a few hours away from where I like to hunt,
mm-hmm.
I'm able to get up there and start putting cameras out, start getting pictures of bulls in velvet, of who actually is moving back into those areas. And as you roll into summer, the bulls aren't going to be necessarily where they're going to be during September. But with experience, I'm able to know they like to summer here, cows are here, they're going to end up here or whatever, right? A lot of times the bulls are up in those higher basins by themselves in their bachelor groups for the summertime. The cows are down lower calving, and, it's kind of that two-thirds up where they'll actually meet for September.
Gotcha.
But, you know, that's I start as early as I can because I like having as much information as I possibly can.
Yeah, I used to do that a lot. I used to start pretty much, excuse me, I used to do it all year round, actually. I'd run cameras all the time because, you know, if we had late season elk tags or clients with late season elk, I'd know where they're going to be the next season, you know. But, you mentioned, so you put up cameras. What are you looking for to put up cameras, or what are you doing with your cameras? Are you putting out minerals with it, or are you just putting them on water hole or travel corridors? What's your trail camera system, so to speak, your protocol?
Yeah. So I have to put cameras on areas where elk want to visit naturally. Idaho has a little bit different rule. You are allowed to use minerals for the attraction solely of taking pictures. Okay?
Right.
So that's the rule. But you cannot hunt that area then for 365 days.
So what do they mean by that area?
Like that's, what, and that's the pro, that's
a couple
the
hundred yards?
I've asked a couple game wardens, and I've gotten a different response from every single one. Some
really?
Say you can't sit right over it. If you're within a few hundred yards, you're okay.
Uh-huh.
I had another guy tell me, if you put a camera in that drainage and you put minerals on it, you cannot hunt that entire drainage. So
That's crazy. Most of them are like, you know, a couple hundred yards, you can't sit right over it. Most states that have that rule. That's funky.
Yep. A couple years ago, a guy up in one of the wardens up in the area I hunt, they found a camera that had minerals, and they literally watched for the person to go into that basin. And they with the idea they were going to write that ticket, that person a ticket if they entered that basin to hunt.
Unreal.
So for myself, I don't want to risk it. It's not. Yeah, it's not worth it to me to have that issue. So I tend to put it on main trails where, you know, elk are coming back and forth, and you know, watering holes, wallows. Most of the wallows don't get hit until later, but oftentimes wallows have a lot of good grass around them. So while the elk may not be wallowing, a lot of times they'll be either drinking from or feeding near a lot of our wallows, because most of our wallows are natural springs, so they produce a lot of really good lush grass around them, and so they kind of produce their own natural attractant, if you would. So that's how I do it.
Gotcha.
But yeah, it'd be nice to be able to run. I mean, and I honestly feel like beneficial for the animals, because they stop, you know, from what I've seen, like up guiding for the outfit I guided for years, we had salt blocks out there for the horses.
Uh-huh.
And out in some of the fields. Well, the elk would hit those salt blocks a lot, like July, right. You know, early August when they were growing a lot of horn. Because that's mm-hmm. when they need the minerals. But once they go hard horned, they would really wouldn't go touch it at all. They didn't, that mineral deficiency wasn't there so much. So, you know, mm-hmm. I understand maybe the hay thing or the corn, you know, type thing. But salt, you know, I feel like salt shouldn't be an issue, because all you're doing is providing nutrients that those animals honestly need and that we're very lacking in our area of naturally. But
and if you think about it, like, I know this is not so much for, well, I don't know where exactly where you hunt. It depends on where in Idaho, but what region. But like here, hunting over a mineral is really no different than hunting over in a water hole, because
right.
You know, and actually, what do they actually need it? You know, they're going to have to water eventually. And because they're so tied to water, it's not. Yeah, I get it. I mean, I know over here that there are talks about it because of chronic wasting disease, you know, because it's transferred through saliva. And, you know, you got a bunch of elk licking on the same block or yada yada yada.
Oh, that's so true.
I don't know, but I mean, if it's legal, the whole hunting over it, I don't know. I never got that whole thing, but I mean, most of us aren't hunting over mineral anyway. When it's the rut, you know, we're chasing
right,
bugles.
We're chasing bugles, right? We're running around calling. So, you know, if anything, I would just like to see them designate what the area is, like, put in the law what the area is, like, right? If you make it 100 yards or 200, you know, like 300 yards, okay, then great, I won't sit over that. You know, we're talking about, on an average day, we're putting on 6-8 miles of hunting, like, mm-hmm. right? If I have to avoid a 100-yard circle of something, then I would, but like right for me, the cameras is just simply wanting to kind of take an inventory of who's there, what bulls are around, what kind of, you know, what kind of size are we seeing, you know, and I just love doing it. I love getting pictures of them in their natural environment, elk doing elk things, and that's fun. But
mm-hmm.
you know, it's, they move so much from where they are in the summer, where I get pictures of them in the summer, to where I actually hunt them, that or it's just, I don't know. It's different. I just enjoy it, but it gives you a good idea. It gives you an idea what you're working with.
Yeah. Gotcha. So, you know, leading up to the hunt, let's say I'm just going to throw out an arbitrary date. Opening day is September 1st. What are you doing that week leading up to the hunt?
So leading up to the hunt, I get all my food and everything laid out first. We backpack hunt a lot, so all of my food I end up putting in 1 gallon Ziploc bags. So this day is in a Ziploc bag. Day one is a Ziploc bag. Day two is a Ziploc bag. Day three. That way I'm looking at calorie intake, how much, you know, food, what my calorie counts are, mixing it up, making sure I have a variety of food because, you know, I can't eat the same protein bar, if you would, for, you know, 4 days in a row.
Right.
I'm not a big protein bar fan. I'm more of a, you know, fruit and nuts, trail mix, you know, and then something, you know, you need a good mix of protein and sugars because a lot of times when you're eating, your energy is falling at that point. You need some quick energy. Now you need to make, you know, you're mixing it with protein so you have kind of a long-term energy, but you also, I think one of the things some people get so hung up on the anti-sugar thing, but it's very important for hunting and making sure that you're keeping your blood sugars up, not getting shaky, not getting, you know, letting your blood sugar crash, you know, because you're only running on protein or something like that. So a big concern is for me is making sure my food is in order, because long before then, I have broadhead arrows built. I spin and I'll spin a bunch of arrows and find the absolute straightest, truest arrow, weigh my broadheads out and try to get everything as close as I can of this arrow weighs, 1 grain more. This broadhead weighs 1 grain less, so I put those two together. This one is half-half. So I kind of weigh all my broadheads, weigh my arrows, and get everything as straight and possible as possible. And then I spin everything to find which arrow spins the absolute truest. I shoot good arrows, so none of them are, like, way out of tune, but there's always, it seems like, a couple of them that are just perfect. Like, everything, you know, every cut, the glue, the inserts, everything just lined up perfectly. And then I number them. So my absolute best arrows, arrow number one, number two, number three, number four, and I do that for six arrows. So I have six really good, you know, arrows that are numbered accordingly. And but I do that about 2 weeks before archery. And then I don't shoot those arrows. I just have them set up as they are and then keep shooting my bow. And then when I'm for preparation before the hunt, I do a lot of holding my shot. So at that point, you should not be trying to get better the week before a hunt. You're kind of, a week before a hunt, you're kind of where you're going to be. You know, you can shoot some more maybe if you've not been shooting to knock the rust off, but I really think people should be shooting, you know, at least a month solid before so they're building that muscle back. But for me, the week before, I'm focusing on being able to draw, hold my shot for an extended period of time. The way I like to do it is I draw back, count to 100, and then release. And I do that in my garage because it's 10 yards across my garage. So I just, it's not even a long shot. It's just holding, and then shooting a bullseye at 10 yards.
Mm-hmm.
Draw back, holding. Because, you know, the thing is a lot of times when we're, if you got a bull coming in and he hangs up and you're already drawn, being able to hold and draw could be the difference between you killing that bull and not killing that bull. But,
sure.
You know, that's just that, the week before, that's kind of my focus is just making sure that everything's perfect, right? You're not scrambling the night before the hunt to pack things. I'm one of those that I want everything packed, everything ready a week before the hunt.
Mm-hmm.
And then for scouting, I don't mess with the elk the after 2 weeks. When you're talking about the last weekend before opener, let's say, so maybe it'd be 12 mm-hmm. days or 13 days, depending on how the year lays out. I go up that weekend, you know, the 2 weeks-ish before. That's my last okay. trip up in there to scout, to pull SD cards, pull cameras out. You know, because I tend to pull cameras out of the field during hunting season. Because, A, it keeps cameras from getting stolen or messed with. Because
yeah.
you go from, you know, scouting season, you really only have the hardcore people that are out there, right? And for the most part, the hardcore guys respect other hardcore guys' stuff.
Right.
I've never had a camera stolen or messed with during the off season, during scouting.
Right.
No, they've never been messed with. They have been messed with during hunting season. So I pull my cameras, you know, that 2 weeks before. I pull cameras, get everything out. I may leave a couple cameras like on a wall, like on a wallow or two, but as far as the majority, 90% of my cameras come out. And
right.
mainly because that week before, I don't like to mess with those elk. That 2 weeks before, they're kind of starting to move out of their summer area to where they're going to be for the opener. I have an idea who's going where, what basin, maybe this bull or that bull want it move into. And then I stay out. I don't want to mess with them. I don't want to push them. I don't want to bump them the week before. Because if you do bump one 2 weeks before, they're long since settled down by the time hunting season rolls around. But
yeah, that's for sure.
But that's kind of my, I don't know if you say superstition of I don't mess with them for that, you know, 12, 14 days before the season.
I mean, I've heard it both ways, you know, and it depends on the areas that you hunt. Like if you're in an area that there's a lot of recreationalists through the summer, like a lot of campers and stuff, and elk are bumping into people all the time. Yeah, it usually doesn't make a big, you know, it doesn't. But, you know, some of these areas where they don't see people, you know, maybe once in their life, twice in their life, then, you know, that could definitely have a drastic effect.
They freak out. For most part, these elk, if they see somebody, it was probably only me throughout the summer. Like, right, I'm the only person that's going in some of those areas during the summertime to put a camera out. You know, that's just simply it. And so for me, it's trying not to ruin all my hard work.
Yeah, no, for sure.
But it's publicly at elk hunting, right? You know, so you're one person away from them deciding to ride their horse up that basin the day before archery season opens or something. And that's kind of funny because, funny story from last season. Had an area, had scouted, had a bunch of bulls in the area, ton of cows. Opening morning of archery season last year, my hunting partner Mark and I wake up out of our tents, crawl out, go over the ridge from where we're at, start glassing, bugle, instantly get a couple bugles back, right? Perfect start to archery season. And sun comes up so we can start seeing. We've got 121 elk about 500 yards from us. And we're like, wow, that's a pretty good group to start off in the morning. So we've got a couple of the smaller bulls bugling. We got one bull that we got him worked up. He came across the drainage, came up below us, and we could hear him in the timber below us, but he never – he wouldn't come up out of that timber across the meadow that was between us, across the sage flat. So, you know, he rolls back over, goes back, and so we're on these elk. Try to get on them. It had no real shots. Had a couple small bulls we looked at that we could have moved in that they bedded, but opening day, right? We're trying to kill a couple big bulls. And so fast forward throughout the day, we've been on elk all day, no shots fired. Wake up the next morning, literally had two bulls bugling above our tent all night long. I slept through most of it. It kept Mark up pretty much all night. So he was pretty pissed off in the morning. He was ready to kill an elk the next morning. So they were literally like 300 yards above our tents. And mind you, we're backpacked in several miles. Mm-hmm. We roll around on these elk. I'm calling the one. He's raking the ground. He's throwing grass up in the air. Mark's trying to get, you know, an angle on him. And then the wind swirled, pushed him out. So we're like, oh, okay, well, that sucks, but it was still fun, right? We've had a day and a half of we're just an elk, elk, elk. So apparently these mountains we're in, it's the shortest distance between a summer range where they run cows and a winter range. Mm-hmm. So they literally come up over this range of mountains and push these cows like, you know, 10, 15 miles.
Wow.
So we're up there elk hunting. We're on a really nice bull that I've watched all summer. He's a nice 6x7. He's bedded on this face with a dozen cows. We're in the rocks 100 yards from him, just a little too far. We're at the edge of the rocks, but where they come out of where they're bedded is a trail like 20 yards below us. That's where they come. They bed up in this little cut, and then they come out this trail. So we're confident. We've got cameras set up. We're all ready to, you know, we're thinking this is just going to be awesome, right?
Right.
We're sitting there, and it's been like an hour, and all of a sudden, all those elk jump up at once and literally run over the top of the rocks where they were, which is not their normal route, but like they're like up panicked and run over the top. We're like, what the heck? We're checking wind. We're like, we don't know what happened. So we're sitting there listening, kind of shaking our heads going, what happened? Also, we start hearing whoop, yeah, you know, and stuff. We walk over the edge and look down. There's this cattle drive coming over the mountain where they're pushing a whole bunch of cows, bunch of cowboys, and it literally ran all of the elk off this mountain out of this area. Like, jeez. You know, here we are in elk. So we end up going back to the camp, to packing up our tents and hiking out, right? But, you know, that's public land elk hunting. You literally have no idea what's going to happen. For us, a whole summer of scouting and watching these elk, and, you know, washed out and with, because the cows came home basically over the top of the mountain range. And
that's crazy.
So we ended up moving and gone on elk again. But right, we're backpacked in. We're set there for we're just, you know, plan to be there 5 days and try to get a couple of these bulls killed. And you know, but that's the thing with public land elk hunting. You just never know what's going to happen.
Yeah. I actually had a similar thing happen to me with sheep herders in Utah, but for deer hunting, so not for elk. And
yeah,
I was stalking this buck, and I was like, you know, I was in there. I was already in the kill zone. I just need to maneuver myself, and all of a sudden, three cowboys come pushing sheep up from the bottom and blew them out of there, pissed me off. But yeah, you know. I can't tell you how many times I have, you know, public land, your shit gets blown up by somebody else. I got some crazy stories.
Oh, yeah, right, great. We've all been there and been watching an animal. And, you know, here comes the guy walking up the trail, has no idea they're there, runs 100 elk out, right, you know, or 50 elk out of an area because he's just not watching the wind, not doing, he's walking right up it and blows them, you know, all out of a basin. Yeah, that's just the nature of it. But, you know, for us, the backpack hunting has been kind of a big deal for us because it just gets us away from a majority of the people. But,
Yeah, well, I feel like that's getting more and more popular.
Yeah, it's certainly... It's you see a lot more people back there than you used to, you know. But that's why we've tailored our gear to get lighter, so we can go further than other people. You know, because a lot of the, you know, backpacking gear is very specific, very specialized. For me, I've, you know, spent a lot of time and effort and money figuring out what really works back there, you know, and fine-tuning my gear. You know,
right.
Biggest thing is, you know, running a good pack, and I run that XO Mountain gear. I have a 3,500 bag and a 5,500 bag. And for the most part, because of how the gear that I run, I'm able to run the 3,500 for 3 to 5 days and stay light, stay mobile. So,
right.
You know, I run that, you know, that XO Mountain gear pack. And then my sleep system weighs basically less than 5 pounds for tent, everything.
Wow. What are you using on that?
So I'm running a Nemo Blaze two-person tent.
Okay,
they
yeah.
call it two-person. They call it two-person, but I probably wouldn't want to sleep two people in there. But it gives me enough room for all my gear, but it weighs 2 pounds even. You know, that it weighs 2 pounds. And then I run the Neo Air X-Therm pad in the long wide. So I have good R value. It's like a 5.6 R value. Then the biggest thing that cut weight out for me on all of that was the tent and going to an Enlightened Equipment 10-degree down bag or down quilt there. And it's kind of a hybrid quilt. I run the Enigma, they call it. And
okay.
I've got the long wide and that also. Yeah, and it's but it's got a closed foot box like a mummy bag so you can stay
okay.
warm. Because that was the thing I didn't like about quilts, right? Is you're trying to wrap up or cinch something down and it creates drafts. What I liked so much about it was the fact that with that closed foot box, you can keep warm, but it still is kind of the quilt on the top, so you can open it up when it's early September. But by running that 950 down bag, it's a 10-degree
uh-huh.
bag, but it weighs 22 ounces.
Oh, wow.
So it's super lightweight. So and it being down, it compresses so small that I'm able to put inside a Sita Summit stuff sack that I use. I'm able to put that sleeping pad in there, the little pillow I use, which is a little inflatable pillow. And then I can stuff my quilt in there, and it literally takes up the same space as everybody else's mummy bag or
right,
a lot of
right.
other quilts that you even see on the market, because it just that 950 down, there's not a lot of people out there when I was researching it that are using a 950. So
uh-huh.
that 950 just is so much warmer and compresses so much further than, you know, all the 650 or 750 or 700 downs that you see on most stuff on the market. You know, it is a little more
mm-hmm.
expensive, but for me, you know, it was a huge trade-off. I went from a 20-degree mummy bag that was 2 3/4 pounds, which was still fairly light for what it is, to,
uh-huh.
You know, a 22-ounce, so basically 1 pound, 6 ounce. A warmer setup even, you know, so.
That's
so
cool.
For me, I mean, right, being able to have a 5 pound camp makes it a lot nicer to be able to move around and get in further and go harder than what most people do.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because I don't like the bivy thing. I've got a bivy. I like being able to be off the dirt and be able to cook and kind of relax and be comfortable, because, you know, I'm a big believer in that if your camp is not comfortable, you're not
mm-hmm.
going to rest well, which means you're not going to hunt
100%.
Well. 100%. You know? And I think that's one of the things that people overlook, and they tend to skimp on, you know, their pad or their bag or, you know, those kinds of, they have all this great, you know, gear, whether, you know, like Sitka camo, right? And they got an XO Mountain
right.
gear pack, and they got a Matthews bow, and they got all this stuff that they've spent a whole bunch of money on, and then they want to buy a $20 sleeping bag and
right.
a you know, $10 Walmart pad. And it's like, you know, guys, if you're not resting, if you're not recovering, because
mm-hmm.
you're not going to hunt well. You're going to do good day one, day two, but suddenly those are the, you know, day three, day four, the guys who are hanging out in camp, or they only go hunt the first hour of the morning. And for me, you know, being able to hunt as hard day five as I did day one has been a lot of times the reason we're on elk. You know, that's
a deciding factor for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's funny, like, so I don't backpack hunt almost never because of what you just said. Like, I have such a hard time getting comfortable, even when I have, and I mean, not to sound like a big shot conceited or anything, I can get pretty much any gear I want, you know?
Yeah.
So it's not really about the gear for me. Like, I have a really hard time sleeping as it is in my own bed at my house. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, exactly.
You're throwing, you know, if I got elk bugling around me, man, I'm such a light sleeper, I'd be like, just like your buddy, I'm going to be up all freaking night long.
Right.
I've actually would rather hike or get up earlier in the morning and hike. Like, I'll stay in a motel or I'll truck camp where I can make a really comfortable camp. And then, you know, get away from the people in the morning, just get up earlier and go further. I mean, that takes a lot out of you too, but I feel more rested and I feel like I'm more productive when I do that. And it's just like, you know, it's each his own, whatever works for you.
Right.
The bottom line is if you're not getting good quality rest, right, you're not going to be productive. And I don't know. It takes a lot of time and effort and a lot of attention to detail to fine tune those things and find out what really works and dial everything in. And once you get it dialed in, you know, it's just, you can pretty much plug and play that for every situation that for every different hunting situation or place that you go. So.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and that's like, so last year I was in 6.5 miles and I was on a solo hunt. So I was back there for 4 days by myself, and I never heard or saw another person. Day five, my buddy came back in there. But the night of day three, I had a first. I literally cussed out and yelled at a bull at 1 a.m. So I hike in, and it took several hours to get in there. And I set up camp. Because it's in the evening, it's like 30 minutes of light left, so I'm kind of just glassing around and kind of looking. And I'm literally sitting there looking at Onyx and kind of making a plan for the next day, and I look over to my left, like 200 yards, there's two bulls sitting there staring at me. A 5-point, a 6-point. I'm like, huh, okay. But they didn't seem to really care. They're like looking at me, they're like, what is this Yahoo doing back in here, right? So they start feeding. I grab my bow and I kind of start to go. I tried to kind of make an angle on him. I get over to one little ridge and I'm looking at him. I'm like, 150 yards from him. I cow call. They kind of look and go back to feeding. I'm like, all right. So I back off, go back to my tent. That's like 100 yards from where I am. And it gets dark. Like, I'm like, okay, they're not spooked. I'm not going to try to run. I'm not going to run them out with 5 minutes of light left. I go to sleep. They start bugling. So they bugled pretty much most of the night. I'm sleeping, and every once in a while, a bugle would wake me up when one could get closer, So I wake up the next day. I get on those bulls. They've moved off a little ways. They're like 400 or 500 yards from my tent, right? And some more elk were there, calling elk, moving back and forth. I'm trying to kill. There was one really nice 6-point. So he's my target bull. Trying to kill him. Go throughout the day. Passed on a couple small bulls that came right by me, et cetera. And, at that point, I'm 6.5 miles in by myself. So I really wasn't very trigger happy to go shooting the first 4-point that ran up on me. Because it was a long ways in there to pack out by yourself.
Right. Exactly.
So now I'm 2 solid days, night 3. So I'm 2 solid days been on these elk. Night 3, a bunch of elk moved in. This bull comes up and starts bugling literally 50 yards from my tent.
Oh,
so I can hear him walking around, right? He's right there. He's raking a tree that I can hear. He comes walking up to my tent and literally bugles 10 yards from it, right? I'm like, hey. So he runs off. Right? He screams around top of me, and I'm like, hey. And he runs off. Like he runs off, right? Bugles. 15 minutes later, he literally walked up within 5 yards of my tent of where his tracks were. And walks up, and he walks right up, and he just bah! Right over the top of my tent, right? And I'm like, fuck you! I'm like, you stupid, blah, blah, blah. And he runs off. That's the first time I've literally ever... I'm yelling at him in the middle at 1 in the morning in the backcountry because this bull will literally not stop running up and bugling on top of me. But when I got up in the morning, it was literally from the last spot where he spun when I yelled at him. It was 5 paces from my tent to where he was.
Oh, well, that's crazy.
And then I almost killed him the next morning. He was, or what I think was him, because the way his bugle sounded. Got pretty good listening to his bugle, right?
Yep.
He was up on a ridge with some cows. I started cow calling at him. He's coming down this ridge. I'm sitting there watching him. I'm so intent on him, I didn't realize this spike snuck up right behind me. So all of a sudden I feel like something like watching me, like that sixth sense, right?
Yeah.
I turn and I look, and there's this spike standing there like 10 yards looking at me. Like, what the heck? So when I turn, I look, that spike's like, whoa! He runs off, literally runs right by that 6-point. 6 point's at like 80 yards, looks down where I've been cow calling, looks back where the spike just ran to, looks back and kind of just turns like, okay, we're out of here. and he just kind of wandered up the hill, but, you know, I almost got him knocked down, but... Yeah, that was a fun trip. I didn't put a bull down. I ended up hit a branch. I got on full draw on a bull, a pretty nice bull, and I didn't see a dead branch sticking out. He was at, you know, 46-ish yards, 46, 48. I don't remember exactly off the top of my head. But just enough to where when I shot, there was just enough arc of the arrow that I didn't see it, and it hit it, and that arrow went flying, and he walked off. He didn't even, he heard the whack, he took like 3-4 quick steps, looked around, and just walked off. That was the only shot I got up there, but on a bull that I wanted to shoot, but it's definitely different. I mean, you get a lot of neat experiences in the backcountry, you know, but it's definitely something you have to be prepared for. It's not something you just on a whim go do.
Right. Yeah, and that's the other thing, you know, is you gotta be able to have the time to prepare for it and it helps to have, you know, the knowledge of what to do and how to do it. Like, you know, it's not something you just pick up and just because, you know, you can read things, you can watch things on YouTube and whatever, but, you know, having that firsthand experience is where really, you know, the tire meets the pavement, so to speak, you know?
Yeah. I've made a lot of mistakes to learn what I've learned. You know,
yeah.
I have screwed up a lot of times to, you know, have an idea of maybe not of what not to do. You know, but every year you learn. I mean, every time you're out there, you're learning something new every year. You know, just when you think you've got it dialed, I document my encounters with elk throughout a season. Like, so in a log, I'll write down who and what, where, when I've had elk encounters. And by encounters, I mean like elk I've been communicating with, you know, hunting within 200 yards.
Yeah.
That's kind of my, you know, not, oh, I saw elk on a ridge. That's not what I call an encounter, right? These are elk that I have actively communicated with. And last season I had 38 encounters.
Wow.
Nine of which were small bulls that I passed. So I let nine small bulls walk. pretty confident in my ability to find elk, hunt elk. But it bit me, you know. I don't subscribe to the whole don't pass on the first day what you'd shoot the last day, because
gotcha.
That's how you're never going to. You're never going to kill a bigger bull that way, right? The first bull that you see on opening day is not always going to be a 6 point or a nice 5 point or something like that. You know, those 9 bulls that I passed, there were a few spikes, a couple 4 points, 3 points that I could have shot and just let walk by. But last year was the first year in quite a while that I actually did not kill a bull. And that was a little humbling, because
that happens.
Yeah, I felt like, you know, oh, I can pass on, you know, this smaller bull because I'm trying to kill this bull or that bull. And after walking out the last night, it was a little bit of a little in shock, if you would, right? Because you're like, oh, I'm going to make it happen. I'm going to make it happen. But you got to have confidence, right? You got to have confidence that you can make something happen, or else you're not going to walk up that mountain to go try to get an elk. Like, right? You don't walk up the mountain saying, oh, there's no way I'm going to kill an elk today, but I'm going to walk up this mountain anyways. Yeah, that's not
exactly.
You never know where you're going to see them, where you're going to bump into one, where you're going to call and one shows up while you're eating a sandwich middle of the day, right? You just don't know. But while it stung, and it hurt not getting an elk last year, right, because it's my passion is hunting elk, you got to use it as fuel. You know, like, right, it's what creates the desire, the burn to go harder, go further, train harder. And, you know, because this is public land elk hunting. Like, this is, you know, every tag I've had for elk has been a public land, over-the-counter elk tag. You know, that is it. And, you know, so it's a 10% sport. It's a 10% success rate as far as the industry goes. So it's a tough, you know, it's a tough sport, but there's nothing like it. I mean, right, there's nothing like chasing a bugling bull for me, you know, and, you know, man, it's a passion and I love it. And definitely out for vengeance this year, if you would. I'm looking forward to the rematch. I had a bull that I've had several years experience with, and he is definitely number one on the hit list this year. And he outsmarted me this year, and definitely looking forward to
it. It'll make it that much more sweet once you get him down on the ground.
Right,
and hopefully
exactly.
He'll be bigger.
Right. Exactly. I mean, if it was easy, elk hunting wouldn't have the allure that it does. You know, it's big, it's tough. They live in big and tough country. They're big and tough animals. So, I mean, that's what makes elk hunting.
That's for sure. Well, awesome, man. There's a lot of good tidbits of information in there, and definitely get the juices going of everybody thinking about elk. We're going to do a few more podcasts here coming up, and different styles of hunting elk, and of course, you know, do our calling stuff. So,
cool.
I want to thank you for coming on and sharing your knowledge with us.
No, I appreciate you having me. I always enjoy it. You know.
Hope you knock down this big guy this year. For what other states have you hunted elk in?
Washington. And Colorado.
Cool.
I killed Rosie in 2017 in Washington, and then Colorado last year I went down with my dad, and we just hunted a second season rifle tag, and just had fun. We were on elk every day. I was really trying hard to get him a bull. I seen some different bulls, but just never had a really good shot opportunity, and. I really wanted to see my dad get a bull down there, but the only bull that gave him a good opportunity was a spike, and it's a 4-point minimum down there. But it was fun to go in an area we'd never been, never seen. we decided to do it like 2 weeks before we went. So I spent 2 weeks on Onyx maps, basically gridding an area trying to learn it in 2 weeks. And went down there, and it was fun. Opening morning, first light, we had a bull there. Wasn't sure if he was legal. He had extra points on there. We weren't sure if he was a 3-point, 4-point. Couldn't tell brow times if they were 5 inches. It was just kind of happening kind of quick. So we didn't make that shot. But, to be able to go someplace never seen before, never been, and be on elk every day, see elk every single day, was fun. It was a great time. But that's what, that hunt with my dad, he doesn't archery hunt with me. He doesn't do the backpacking thing. To be able to go spend some real quality time, with my father, that's what it's about right there. That trip was so much fun. And, at the end of the day, what hunting, it makes it so special.
That's what it started out for most of us.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, that was a lot of fun, but, certainly going someplace you've never been before, the Onyx made a big difference. We don't know where's the trail, where's property lines, where's all that good stuff. So
definitely helps. Well, awesome, man. I want to thank you for coming on. I'll check back in with you once we get closer to season, and maybe we'll have you back on after the season and see if you put that other guy down.
I appreciate it. Thanks, John.
All right. Have a good one.
Hey guys, just a couple of quick closing thoughts. If you want to stay connected with the podcast, check out my blog, johnstallone.me. That's johnstallone.me. And it's a nice place to catch all my articles, game recipes, workouts, all kinds of good stuff that goes hand in hand with the podcast. Another thing I want to talk to you about is if you're looking for a safe place to be part of a community on social media, I want you to go and check out Broadhead Nation on Facebook. If you're not already a member, it's a nice place where everybody should feel comfortable to ask questions, to be part of a community. They do a really good job. That's Broadhead Nation on Facebook. Check it out.